Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson. Joining me in a bit will be Peter Salmon, and we will tackle this week's review together. And we're kind of getting back into a train of tackling Black filmmakers. It is Black History Month, although we did do a review last week where the cast was Black. The director, however, was not, and that kind of broke the streak we were on of three Black filmmakers in a row, and now we are back to another Black filmmaker, although they have been predominantly Black stories, and that's been a fun ride to have been on the last few weeks, and we are back on the ride again. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new crime drama biopic Judas and the Black Messiah, which you can now watch on the various premium video on demand sites, so your Google Play, your Apple Store, your Cineplex Store, and Microsoft, wherever you find the movies you like to watch. So, before we get into that, it has been a very, not a busy week for movie news, but it has been a very complicated week for movie news. And, you know, particularly, you may have heard a lot about, quote-unquote, cancel culture. And when we're sort of thinking in those regards, there are a lot of people, particularly a lot of politicians, who use the term cancel culture. And they mean that as a disparagement. There's this thing called cancel culture that's like a cancer on our discourse right now. I prefer what how Desmond Cole, the activist and journalist, phrased it on an episode of Canada Land. I think it was last year. He called it a culture of responsibility, which is, we're not canceling people so much as we're trying to get them to be held to account for the things that they've said and they've done. And so in this spirit this week, one of the biggest news stories was what happened to an actress named Gina Carano, who you may recognize as one of the henchmen in Deadpool. She has become slightly more famous because she had a role on The Mandalorian, the Disney Plus Star Wars series. She was going to be spun off into her own separate show. It looked like that is not going to happen anymore. She was also a famous MMA fighter as well. That was how she got her start. She was a professional MMA fighter, very successful MMA fighter. So she has a real physical presence. But she's been, a thorn in the side for a while because of some views she's expressed on social media. She was accused of being transphobic for mocking the use of preferred pronouns. She changed her pronouns on Twitter to beep bop boop, which a lot of people thought was mocking those who do not use the two gender pronouns, people who identify themselves as they or them or use some other pronouns, not necessarily the she or him. And anyway, she posted that on social media and got soundly criticized for that. There was also some things she posted about voter fraud in the U.S. election. She mocked mask mandates. She was seen as sort of, you know, making fun of or, you know, trying to undermine the public response to COVID-19 by insisting that mask mandates weren't a real necessary thing. So this is who Gina Carano is, and it kind of came to a head this past week when she posted on social media a picture of people being rounded up in the Holocaust, and she said the following, and I'm quoting here, she said, "Jews were beaten in the streets not by Nazi soldiers, but by their neighbors, even by children, because history is edited. Most people today don't realize that to get to that point where Nazi soldiers could easily round up thousands of Jews, the government first made their own neighbors hate them simply for being Jews. How is that any different for hating someone for their political views?" Unquote. A lot of this a lot of people took this as Gina Carano basically comparing herself to Holocaust survivors. You know, she's saying that because she has conservative political views, she is being, I guess, in a Holocaust herself, which a lot of people took the exact right way, which is shocking. Like, how could you, because of your political speech, compare yourself to someone who was a victim of the Holocaust? So she was fired from The Mandalorian, fired from Lucasfilm. She is now working with The Daily Wire on a film project. The Daily Wire is this right-leaning website by Ben Shapiro, who is himself said a lot of controversial things. So I think at the end of the day, it's going to be there's going to be a question of if Ben Shapiro and his own media empire, whether they will be as good at producing movies as they have been at producing journalism, which is to say not very good at all. But I mean, Gina Carano has sort of cast herself as the victim in all of this, and she's had some defenders, most notably Senator Lion Ted Cruz, as well as this man, Jonathan Chait, who is a columnist for New York Magazine, who basically said that being conservative in Hollywood now is like the new blacklist, which I don't think is true. There are a lot of conservatives in Hollywood. I can think of Kelsey Grammer, who's still working fairly regularly. Clint Eastwood, he's still cranking out movies. I mean, are there many conservatives in Hollywood? No. Are there many of them who keep their conservative ideas to themselves? Yes. But, I mean, I wouldn't call it a blacklist. I mean, who else is on the blacklist along with Gina Carano? Kevin Sorbo, Anthony Sabato Jr., Scott Baio. I mean, come on. It's not like Anthony Sabato Jr. was like racking up Emmys and Oscars one day and then he was on the quote unquote blacklist. He was an underwear model who started getting some acting work, not a lot of great acting work. You know, he's getting guest starring roles and things. So I mean, you know, let's keep things in perspective. At the same time last week, we had another example of sort of toxic masculinity in Hollywood. We had Charisma Carpenter, who was one of the stars of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and she was spun off into with Angel in the Buffy the spinoff series called Angel. And there has been a lot of discussion about what happened to her, the circumstances by which she left the series, and I won't get into the complicated narrative situation by which she left Angel. Basically, she got pregnant during the show's fourth season and ended up being written off the show at the end of the fourth season. She comes back for one episode to wrap up her character's arc in fifth season, and she basically dies off screen. And a lot of people then, as now, thought that Charisma Carpenter was done kind of dirty by this, and it turns out she was, because she released this multi-page statement on social media talking about how she felt used and abused by Buffy and Angel creator Joss Whedon. And of course, this is not new so far as Joss Whedon is concerned. There were all those allegations last year about Ray Fisher accusing Joss Whedon of abuse and racist behavior on the set of Justice League. What is kind of really stunning here is Charisma Carpenter seemed to pop a cap that released a flurry of accusations, people standing with her. People like Michelle Trachtenberg, who had a kind of a tepid statement of support to begin with, not tepid in terms of its intent, but just like she kind of limited herself. She's like saying, like, look, I'm busy, I'm raising my family, I could say a lot about this, but all I will say is I support Charisma Carpenter. And her analysis of things on the set of Buffy was correct. She then released sort of a more full-throated statement where she said that basically she wasn't allowed to be left in a room alone with Joss Whedon, which, eesh, that is truly horrible to hear looking back. I mean, Amber Benson has said some things about her time on Buffy before, but you also get Eliza Dushku now coming out with support. Eliza Dushku, who was on not just Buffy and Angel, but she was also on a subsequent Joss Whedon series, Dollhouse. And then perhaps most damning at all was Sarah Michelle Gellar coming out and saying that she is sort of proud of her time as Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but that there is a lot that is left to be said about Whedon's legacy on the show and her opinions of him and his attitudes while producing that show. Interestingly, there hasn't been a lot from the writers, and of course Whedon has long been a very heralded for his writing, but one writer, Jose Molina, who was a writer on Firefly, also came out with his statement saying that there was a lot going on with Whedon as an abuser and someone who liked to make people cry, especially women. And he related one story about how Whedon bragged about the time he made a woman writer cry twice in one day. And of course, this is not what you want to hear about the Joss Whedon, the creator of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, one of the greatest sort of feminist genre icons of the last 20, if not 30, 40 years even. It's shocking that, I mean, because I know Buffy means so much to so many people, and a lot of these people are in marginalized groups, especially young women. People are still discovering Buffy the Vampire Slayer to this day, and are grooving with it, and its messages still resonate 20 or 30 years later, and I think this really does release some air for a lot of people that there was a pretty bad guy behind this show with a surprisingly positive message, given the nature of the man behind it. It's disappointing, I guess. Never meet your heroes, or never learn behind-the-scenes details about your heroes are like on social media, I guess, is also the lesson here, too. It's just, There will be more to come on this, I think. I think, you know, for Chris McCarpenter to unload, again, because a lot of this has kind of squirted out over the years, but to have all of it, to sort of read the full story in one place, I think loosened, again, not to use the cat metaphor too much, but did loosen the cap for a lot of people to start telling their own stories. So I'd be very surprised if what we heard in last week is the end of this. I mean, given two, this is kind of frivolous, but it is connected. We had the latest trailer for the Snyder edit of the Justice League come out over the weekend, and of course, because Joss Whedon, all this news about Joss Whedon came out, that people were especially dunking on his Joss Whedon cut of the film, which has been much maligned, and not just by people who are in the sort of the Snyder cult, and I will call it a cult. People are absolutely enamored with anything and everything Zack Snyder, but there are reasons to rightly criticize Justice League. I will say that I did not see anything in that trailer that made me more excited to see that Snyder cut, perhaps even less excited to see that Snyder cut. If you see, like, the people are posting these side-by-side comparisons of the character design for this, the main villain in the film, Steppenwolf. And one, he's got, like, the Snyder one, he's all covered in spikes and things. And the Whedon, in the Whedon version, he's much more streamlined. And I'm looking at this thinking, ugh, the character design is ugly in both circumstances, but the Snyder design is way uglier. But there's this kind of pride, I guess. There's this kind of pride that the Snyder fans are taking. They're really enjoying this undermining of Whedon. Again, his own fault, Joss Whedon. But they're really kind of enjoying watching his downfall in a way that I don't find especially becoming, especially since I think Snyder's vision is not much to write home about. It's just not, it's, you know, you had two movies starring the three biggest superheroes in the world. They make barely $1.5 billion together. Aquaman makes $1 billion alone. To me, the audience has spoken. They reject the Snyder vision for these characters. This is going to feed a very small portion out of the audience. I have a feeling it's going to be dropped. All the Snyder heads are going to be super excited, and then it's going to be gone. Of course, this drops on March 18th, and it will be available here on Crave in Canada. So you have that to look forward to. I didn't get a chance to get into this. I saw this review on The Hollywood Reporter for this this movie, Me, You, Madness, which is written, directed, and starring Louise Linton, who you may or may not know was the wife of the former Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, who, his own background, he funded a lot of big Hollywood movies before he was the Treasury Secretary. So things like King Arthur, I think it was King Arthur Legend of the Sword, the Guy Ritchie King Arthur, but also Suicide Squad and a couple other movies. But she's now made her own movie. And I'm just going to read a bit from this Hollywood Reporter review. In its tiresome attempts to send up its star's image and not take itself too seriously, the film becomes exceedingly laborious. The lead performers don't do so much wink at the camera as leer at it and threaten to lick it all over. And we're threatening to so many lascivious shots of Linton's toned, bared physique that one would accuse the filmmaker of sexual exploitation if it were not Linton herself. So go see Yumi Madness if you want to see someone be completely voyeuristic of themselves. Anyway, I'll leave that there. We're going to do a review of Judas and the Black Messiah, a movie that is worth your time to see. Before that, though, we're going to pay further tribute to Black History Month with this track from Swindle, Take It Back, and we will take it back to the 1960s in a minute. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. Where I go from here, it only I can design. Where I go from here, when I take it back, I reminisce on the story I came from. When I take it back, I reminisce on the story I came from. Only you can design your future. Only you, only you. Only you can design your future. Only you.
Look, we oppressed your people for a long time.
I didn't oppress it. And my folks grew up poor. They were sharecroppers.
AKA the overseer.
What if the overseer had banded with the slaves and cut the masters through? What then, comrade?
We might not be in this funky ass ghetto right now. I'm not talking about the west side or the south side. I'm talking this filthy ass mall right here. Shit. We almost got into it with a rat over a parking space. I bet y'all babies getting the same bullshit education. Y'all paying the same taxes to get your heads whooped in by the same old pigs. Ain't that a trip? We paid in. We paid the pigs to run us off of our corners. Let me ask y'all something. If this building caught fire right now, what would y'all worry about, huh? Water and escape. If somebody would ask you, what's your culture during this fire, brother? Water. That's my culture. Well, how about your politics? Water and escape. Well, guess what? America's on fire right now. And until that fire's extinguished, don't nothing else mean a damn thing.
And that was a clip from the film Judas and the Black Messiah. It's the new film from Shaka King, and it stars Daniel Kaluuya, Lakeith Stanfield, Jesse Plemons, Dominique Fishback, LG Smith, and Martin Sheen. I am now being joined on the line by Peter Salmon. Peter, how are you today?
Doing good. Just living life in this, all this COVID jazz, doing good. Still doing the whole school thing they got going on, so,
But it is reading week, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah. Oh, that's sweet. Yeah, I hope you're all enjoying reading week.
Now that everyone's been reminded that it is reading week and break from studies, happened at the same time, unlike the young people out there and their teachers who are going to doing
that's true.
April break this year.
Yeah. Well, it's still called March. They still call it March break. But yeah, no, I know what you mean. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
What, moving March break?
Yeah.
Well, I think the arguments about people wanting their regularly scheduled break in order to have a break from everything, break from classes, because I think people forget kids have been still doing their classes just remotely. It's not like Christmas break extended to last week is what I'm saying.
No, it's been, I think, break still is needed, but I think April's fine.
Good. Well, I'm glad we sorted that out. So that we can get
totally
down
related to end credits and film.
And this week's movie, which is Judas and the Black Messiah, which was originally supposed to, well, I mean, I guess in some places it is in theaters, not here. But Peter, you chose this from the hat, as it were. So what drew you to Judas and the Black Messiah?
Oh, well, I love all that jazz. I'm actually in my digital humanities fourth year. I'm dealing with the Black Panthers right now. So just, there's just a bunch of reasons. I love Daniel Kaluuya, Lakeith Stanfield. It's gold, Everything was there. And also, I always mad respect when the director doesn't have a Wikipedia page. Because, you're giving support. Although, fun fact, as of yesterday, he now has a Wikipedia page. 2 days ago, nope, now he does.
Oh,
and,
good.
And not me. I'm not hinting at that. It happened. So that's good.
It wasn't Peter that started the Shaka King Wikipedia page.
So just and honestly, I think it's great that we're doing it for Black History Month. I was not thinking about that when we did this. So I don't know. Well, also, I think I told you, my dad wanted to watch this before we knew about it. So it's just, I don't know. This film's been in my roster for a while. And so, What about you?
I thought it was really engaging. I like the two actors in it, as you said, Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield. I thought they were really great. I like the setup of it. It kind of feels like The Departed, a bit.
Yeah, exactly.
Except it's true to life, and it's let's just say that there are a lot of morally dubious stuff in there, even more morally dubious than The Departed. So it's
well, it's very that was its point.
I think
right?
There's a lot to recommend it.
I thought it was really great. I do want to. I don't think the structure of it is anything new. It is just kind of a regular biopic, but the acting and what it is a biopic of really, I think, overpasses that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. You know what I mean? It's Black Klansman and stuff. There's similar biopics already out there, but this one is just a great one. It's just a phenomenal one. So I'm not saying it's anything new. But it is, it's great. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
No, it doesn't break the mold. And I think that's fine. There is value in, and I've said this a lot on the show. Yeah, it following the formula isn't a bad thing. Following the formula badly is bad. But if you can do the formula well, then I think that's fine. The formula exists for a reason. I am curious, though. You said you were studying Black Panthers at the moment.
And I think there is a curiosity factor in terms of how this holds up to history. I've read that Fred Hampton Jr., who is the son of the Fred Hampton, who was played by Daniel Kaluuya in the movie, that he was on set and he was correcting a lot of stuff as it was as the film was being made. So, I mean, just from your experience, what do you think historically about the movie? How does it hold up?
I thought it was, yeah, it was pretty spot on. It didn't go like very in depth into the structure of the Black Panthers or anything like that, but it's it definitely showed how it's had a really strong Chicago end, right? My focus is more on the Oakland and you know, just that in general where it spread, but I thought that's already been done, so I thought it was especially great. This one was, yeah, solely Chicago and dealing with all those figures, you know. Bobby Seale didn't get a single mention, and then Huey P. Newton just got a couple, and I'm very okay with that. That, and I thought their correlation with the opposing gangs was very, very well done. Very mm-hmm. well done. And it is, you know, it is all the things that happened in the film that made them unionize, you know? Not actually unionize, but become more comrades after. I think it's not accurate fully when it comes to the individual characters, but it's very, very... it's a strong look at the Black Panthers, absolutely. But you know, of course, the main character, Fred Hampton, he was purposely in this portrayed as a prophet, you know, but he was pretty great. I just mean we didn't get like a full in-depth look into his life. But I thought we got as much as we need about William Bill O'Neill, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he doesn't, I personally think, you know, deserve more details than what he got. He got enough is what I'm, you know, what I'm cool with. Yeah. I think the one of my favorite parts of this was its correlation to not correlation, the just the part of it that had to do with the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover, especially, you know, people usually just don't necessarily think of him in a bad way, but he was not a great guy. So I thought that was phenomenal. But what I really thought was special about this is their screen time was very minimal in comparison. There's a lot of films like this where the FBI and what they're doing would have kind of overpassed, but we just got a glimpse of it. We got to see enough of it. And the one who played him, his name's not even on the thing, but the other FBI guy that was helping out, not J. Edgar Hoover, or Jesse Plemons, obviously, the other guy, I appreciated that he was like, he was always drinking and he was always super drunk. And I know it was like over, it was hyperbolized a bit, but it was very well done. I thought that was great.
Mm-hmm.
And little small things like, what's his name? Bobby Rush was in it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Daryl Brett Gibson. And I maybe I'm wrong. I think Bobby Rush was the one who said he's got to go back to his family, right? And then just kind of a small glimpse of, you know, how that's going to, you know, what's going to happen with him after, and how even though he's not a part of that shooting, he's really still a strong supporter for, you know, the civil rights. So I thought that was cool. I might be mistaken, but I think it was that character. And either way, just Bobby Rush being in it, but them not really saying his name, I thought that was cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what about you? Any other?
Well, I'm going to unpack some of the things you mentioned. The Martin Sheen, I don't know what they were thinking with Martin Sheen. No. Like first of all, it's kind of interesting they hire Martin Sheen because he's kind of a well-known lefty agitator. So he's like exactly the kind of person that J. Edgar Hoover would have a big stack of papers about. but like the makeup,
yeah, I could. Well, yeah, maybe. The makeup wasn't good. It was not a good job.
The makeup was horrible. He looked sweaty. And maybe that was kind of the point, but I'm not sure you need to like to make J. Edgar Hoover, you know, like Night of the Living Dead to to sell him like as a said, bad guy. He was definitely a bad guy.
It could have been purposeful, I guess. There's what is it? I think the Watchmen film, it really is a hyperbolized or exaggerated Nixon. So it's been done, you know, and I kind of get that, but no, I don't think it it worked well with good old J. Edgar Hoover.
Mm-hmm. It's but I mean, having said that, that it's I was okay with that. When I to what you said about it not going too deep into like the FBI's operation, it went just deep enough to show just how sort of corrupt that investigation was. Like, no matter how you're concerned about the violence of that's happening in the Black Panther Party, it's kind of heavily implied that Bill O'Neill, and I think this stands up to real life, that Bill O'Neill was not the only FBI informant in the Chicago Black Panther Party. And because there's that scene later in the bar when he's approached by the other black man who gives him the...
Oh, do you think... Okay, that makes sense. Do you think that's what he was saying? That he's
right,
also
yeah.
Kind of a... Okay.
Well, and there's also the whole sequence about like how George Sams was an informant, and they pretty much let him get away with murder because he was the FBI informant, even though he ended like someone else was killed for being an informant. And yeah, it's just implied that.
Well, so who you mentioned? I think we should. It's Little Rel Howery, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who played that little role? Yeah, Wayne.
Right. It's yeah. There's little things like that that just shows like there was just such a lack of ethical investigating that like the FBI of today would never be allowed to get away with any of this stuff, and like to just have like to just like to set informants against each other and to basically arm twist it, because at the end it's kind of I will disagree with you. I'm not sure they went deep enough into Bill O'Neill's character. Because I think there's quite a big difference from like where he is at the beginning of the movie, where he's kind of very apathetic and like apolitical, and to this interview clip they have of him at the end, where he's like, "Well, say what you want about me, but I was in the movement." And it's like, "Well, dude, you're in the movement because the FBI told you to be in the movement, or you were going to jail." So like, how do you get from a point where you're like, I don't care about the movement. I have no opinion either way about Malcolm X or Martin Luther King, to being like, well, I was in the movement. So I did more than most people, even though you were there because you didn't want to go to jail. There's some blanks that were not filled in necessarily about Bill O'Neill that I wish they had taken a bit more time to fill in, because I feel like Fred Hampton was really a full-blooded character, and you got a real sense of the things that drove him and of why people found him so captivating. One of the things that kind of really sticks out as a sore thumb, and unfortunately it's sort of the nature of the business, is that Lakeith Stanfield and Daniel Kaluuya are men in their late 20s, early 30s, and in real life Fred Hampton was 21 when he was killed.
Well, it's just messed up.
Yeah, it's kind of... The disparagement is kind of noticeable, and that was like in the back of my head watching the film. Especially at the end where it has the title cards that says, like, you know, Fred Hampton was 21 when he was killed. And it's like, well, Daniel Kaluuya was no 21.
I'm not gonna lie, that did cross my mind as well. Yeah. That's a small thing, but yeah, no, he it's definitely Daniel Kaluuya looks older than 21. Absolutely, yeah.
it's a small thing. It's just, it's also a matter of, right, like, could you find a 21-year-old who has that natural kind of magnetism and that natural. Like leadership ability. I mean, I think at a certain point they were looking at Jaden Smith to play Fred Hampton, and I think if we lived in that universe, we'd be complaining bitterly about the crappy job Jaden.
Yeah, jeepers. I'm glad that was not the decision.
So it's an either or scenario, to be sure. Do I want it the part well played, or do I want like an age authentic actor? Well, I'd rather see it well played, because then I can feel engaged with the material. So
yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, I could a bit more of Bill O'Neill could have been put in there for sure. Because I think his kind of evolution of you know, whether he agrees with the Black Panther or whether he actually feels like a member. That was kind of, would you say, a bit too subtle? There wasn't really kind of any part where he's, you know, doing the equivalent of looking in a mirror and trying to figure himself out, you know? Or well, do you think there was enough of a kind of a noticeable evolution of that?
There are subtle things.
There
are certain scenes. Like, there's a scene where after Fred Hampton goes to prison, where he comes barging into the office and he starts talking about how there's an informant here, and I'm going to do everything I can to snuff them out. And then and then you see him go back to his car and leave. And as you see him pulling out, he's like smirking to himself because, like, yeah, I just gave this wicked awesome performance in there. I have them so riled up because I'm the informant.
And that was like halfway. So, yeah, I don't know how fully O'Neill's mind ever changed. So,
And there's a really great scene after Fred Hampton gets out of prison when his case is being appealed, and he goes to the church and he's given this speech and everyone's on their feet. And everyone's got their fists in the air, and there's just this great, power to this scene because you have Fred Hampton delivering the speech, and there's all this sort of insinuating and foreshadowing going on because he's talking about, you know, giving his life for the movement, and then you cut from that and you cut to Dominique Fishback as his girlfriend Deborah, and you see it all on her face. It's like, you see on her face, like she's thinking to herself, oh my God, he could be killed and he's okay with
yeah.
me, even though I'm like 8 months pregnant. And then you also cut from that to Bill O'Neill, because Bill O'Neill's the head of security for Hampton and for the Black Panthers. And he's got his fist raised and he's like doing the call and response, you know, I am a revolutionary. And in the crowd is his FBI handler, Roy Mitchell. And Mitchell's looking at him. And he's trying not to look at Mitchell. And there's this real friction in the scene. Like, Mitchell's trying to remind him what he's there for. And you can see the struggle on Stanfield's face, right? He's just like, I'm trying not to look at this guy who's kind of like the only guy here who knows the real me. And there's that dynamic at play, plus the dynamic of how much at this point is he like really invested in the Panther cause, or how much has he fooled himself into thinking he's there for the cause.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really great scene because it has all the main characters sort of lined up with their conflicts. And other than it's Fred Hampton giving the speech, so there's dialogue, but there's no dialogue between the characters. And, I mean, there's scenes like that where you can kind of read into into what's happening, but I'm not sure there's any kind of we never really fully understand how much of from Bill O'Neill's perspective how much of it was him kind of like quote unquote going native and how much mm-hmm. of it was a show he's putting on. And I wish that was a bit clearer when we get to the end when he's able to give Fred Hampton the barbiturate that sort of knocks him out for the police raid that he gets murdered in. And I mean, that's never really rectified because we go from Fred Hampton's murder. Sorry if there's spoilers here, everyone, but I mean,
it's a history film.
It's
yeah,
a real life fact that Fred Hampton was murdered.
Yeah.
But also you're kind of spoiled on that fact if you saw Trial of Chicago 7. But
oh yeah, that's right.
Fred Hampton is murdered, and we go right from that to seeing the clips of the real life Bill O'Neill in that interview later, and then the archival footage of Fred Hampton speaking with all the little title cards that say what happened afterwards, and I liked it fine.
I thought that was great because it really. It showed how throughout the film, like how great a job they did with like a Stanfield doing the interview, right? Very, very similar looking. So I thought that was cool that they didn't even say it, but it was like the real footage at the end. I know that's been done with biopics too, like Malcolm X that happens, but it's, I don't know, it was done well. I enjoyed it.
No, I liked it fine. I felt there was a scene missing to show what Bill O'Neill's immediate reaction to.
I agree with that. Stan, I think in general, it maybe could have gone on a bit longer, right? It was like just two on the dot. It could have been maybe two and a half or something. Maybe more of a kind of slow look at kind of the last results, you know, the all of the days leading up to the shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, but there could have been like a bit more time of showing Fred Hampton's genuine rise of worry and concern. Also, I double checked, and the person I mentioned being Bobby Rush was. So I absolutely love that. Right before the shooting, the person who plays him, who played Bobby Rush? Let's see here, Daryl Britt Gibson, and he says, mm-hmm. "I got to go back and see my kid and stuff." Right, and then he's mm-hmm. the one who's really and still is a huge part of Chicago and Black rights and everything like that.
He's a congressman.
Yeah, so I is he still a congressman? Either way, he was. Yeah, was pretty sweet. I thought that was well done.
Yeah, Bobby Rush is still the member yes. of the U.S. House of Representatives for Illinois' 1st District.
Yeah, there you go. Good on him.
And he's been there since 1993. So. He's done 3 decades. He's almost coming up on 30 years. So
it's wild.
So yeah, he's, I mean, he's not, he's kind of interesting to think of where he, you know, as right in there with the Black Panthers. And now he's probably one of the least controversial members of Congress, given some of the,
yeah, <there. laughs> yeah, that's true.
But yeah, I think there's to get back to the movie itself, the O'Neill character is I think that he's an interesting character because he gets caught at the beginning, like he's running this con, posing as an FBI agent, and then there's a part of, I can't remember the movie off the top of my head. But there's a couple of movies like this that I'm thinking of where the criminal who gets caught and becomes an informant sort of starts thinking of themselves as the police as well. And there's a bit of that here mm-hmm. because here you have Bill O'Neill, who's like predisposed to posing as a police officer, suddenly becoming an FBI informant. Right. It's just there's something to that. And Lakeith Stanfield tries to fill in the gaps with, you know, sort of the way he's acting and some of the looks he gives. But I mean, it just, I wish that character had been built better, to an extent. And I feel like he doesn't get any real resolution either, because I mean, clearly the real life Bill O'Neill was living with some things, because he's killed himself if people
yeah.
were. And he killed himself apparently right after he did this interview, which is referenced in the movie, the kind of one and only interview he did about his time as an FBI informant. So there's something to that, because he clearly kind of unloads himself and then kills himself. So there was a lot of guilt there under the surface.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and you can kind of see his guilt throughout the film too.
Right. And but there's also stuff like when he goes to Hampton and he's got C4 and he's like we can go blow stuff up. and Fred Hampton's like, "Oh, no, we're not going to do that, because that's going to even more harshly attract police attention to the cause." And as you see him drive away, and you're thinking to yourself, is he like really wound up? Like, is he gone again? Has he gone kind of native? But then as he's driving away, you see him pull the wire out. So he was trying to entrap Hampton and the others into some sort of bombing plot. And you're just thinking, well, again, like what's kind of driving him here? Is he just like desperate to get out and finish it? Like if he gets like a big bust, like if he proves there was some sort of conspiracy involving Hampton and the others trying to blow something up, does that get him off the hook or what's going on?
See, that part though, I thought was well done, because that was like right after J. Edgar Hoover told him to like think outside the box, right? J. Edgar Hoover kind of gave him a hint that he has to do the crimes himself, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And that's kind of what he was doing. He was going over the top and being the one who kind of does, yeah, the full crime.
Mm-hmm.
But I see what you mean for that.
Mm-hmm. That does The other really great scene in the movie, and it has nothing to do with Stan, at least for me, at least, and has nothing to do with Stanfield or Kahlua. It's that scene with Hoover and Mitchell in the office where, and I don't know how Martin Sheen was able to keep a straight face while doing it, but not that it's funny, but I just mean it's horribleness where Hoover says to Mitchell, like, what are you going to do when your daughter grows up and brings a black guy home? And it's just like the stark discomfort in it. And I was reading some commentary online and people are like, oh, well, the Jesse Plemons character, he wasn't like really racist. And it's like, well,
yeah, he was.
I was like, he thought the KKK and the Black Panthers were the same thing, which of course they are not. So there is more than a little systemic racism there. But his, like, it was interesting to watch that character be sort of thrown into what I'm going to call the deep end of racism. Because between the idea that Black Panthers and KKK are the same thing, and J. Edgar Hoover thinking it's the worst thing in the world if your daughter brings a black man home as her boyfriend, there's a great big football field sized degree of racism going from least racist to most racist. And you see Plemons being confronted with like the deep end racism versus his own kind of shallow end racism.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is fascinating to watch.
That was very, very well done. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hey, but you're saying that you bash Martin Sheen. So do you think there's at least a small portion of him that did an okay job?
I think he did an okay job.
The structure of that scene was really great.
That
and scene, he just happened to be one of the individuals in it.
Really played into the kind of the cartoonishness of Hoover, in a way that, you know, that scene you mentioned later where he tells the FBI guys, like, we got to basically kill Fred Hampton because we got to kill Fred Hampton, guys, or else he's going to, you know, be even bigger in prison.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of goes over the line of cartoonishness that the earlier scene. I mean, for the most part, I think Martin Sheen did the job he was hired to do, which is to play like this outlandish, unnuanced, just blatantly racist version of Hoover.
Yeah.
But I mean, in that one scene with Plemons, it works really, really well. In the other scenes where he's like, let's kill Fred Hampton, everybody, that's a little overboard. I mean, again, I'm not trying to save J. Edgar Hoover's reputation, but I think, again, in the big wellspring of humanity from the cartoon supervillain version of J. Edgar Hoover to a sympathetic version of J. Edgar Hoover, maybe we can meet in the middle somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Just one other thing I wanted to point out for it. Like I said, even though it was a really great film, there was like a lack of a specialty to it. Like the cinematography was just, you know, was regular old shots. Very like good shots, but nothing right. new. And I would have been okay if there was more shots of Chicago. Yes. Maybe it was like a purposeful, well, I don't know if it was a purposeful thing because they were very clear. It was Chicago was part of it that I would have loved. Yeah. More, I guess, kind of broad shots of it or more in general, more of them, you know, driving and more shots of them, of the camera outside of the car when they're driving or something, you know? Yeah. Just, yeah. A better look would have been nice. Also,
yes.
Where was the snow? It's Chicago, right? Where was the snow? There's no snow.
Chicago in December. Yeah, there was no snow. I'm glad.
You know what? Maybe it's so historically accurate that it was like a warm winter day or something. Maybe. I don't know. But the whole film, I thought that was a little strange.
I'm not sure. I mean, I would have to look up to see when they shot it, but I have a feeling like they just didn't go to the trouble of laying down fake snow. But
it's an indie film. We got to think that, right?
But you're right. There's a definite lack of Chicago-ness.
Yeah.
To the scenes, and it's not like, I mean, maybe it's because there's been a change in sort of the landscape of Chicago in the last 50, 60 years. But, yeah, there is definitely, it doesn't have the texture. It could have been shot anywhere. I don't know if it was if it was actually shot in Toronto. Toronto typically doubles for Chicago when you need to do Chicago on a budget. But I'm not sure if it was actually okay. It was shot in Cleveland, so that's why it doesn't feel like Chicago.
Yeah, it feels more like Cleveland.
It feels like Cleveland, and Cleveland doubles for anywhere and everywhere. So yeah, I mean that's like you said, that's kind of a gripe, and it's kind of a small gripe at that. But I mean, yeah, if you're watching sort of like the exterior shots, and it feels like there's something missing, that's
one of the main ones. Yeah.
Yeah. I will say that I did like the music a lot. I thought the music was really great.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, I was blanking, but that was a standout for me too. Also, it was mainly the credits, but I've listened to the soundtrack album, and it was really fun. But it's gonna hit the Billboard too. Mm-hmm. And just the score in general, yeah, was really great. Let's see, did a particular person?
It was Mark Isham, who's he's not like a marquee guy when it comes to scores, but he's done a lot of really great work.
Yeah. Oh, well, this is the thing. He did Hitcher. Hitcher's not a great film. Soundtrack, everything was great. So, you know, there's that.
Yeah. He's a good journeyman sort of guy, a scoring guy, a composer. I don't know where my words are today, but he's got a lot of talent, and he's when he stands out, he really stands out. And of course, he didn't do it alone in this. He teamed up with Craig Harris, who's a trombonist.
Yeah.
So that's where you kind of get the nice, because you know Mark Isham's scores typically are very jazzy, but bringing Craig Harris in takes it up a notch, and it has a very good distinctive sort of late 60s sound, even though as we said, it looks like Anywhere USA, which is.
The music, though, was spot on to its era. Yeah.
I agree. Yeah. Any final thoughts before we
let's take up? We did mention her. I thought Dominique Fishback was really good as Hampton's partner. And they could have dived a bit more into that, but I did think it was a fun just kind of side story, but that was present throughout the whole film, you know? Especially because it is his son, right? Fred Hampton Jr. It's something that has continued. So I thought that was cool. It was a nice little subplot going on, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny that this movie comes out and it's, you know, kind of going up for awards against Mank, because I was thinking a lot about that line in Mank where he says you can't tell a person's life in 2 hours. You can only kind of give like a sense of it. And I think this is kind of the perfect example, is, you know, a lot of the things we're talking about, Judas and the Black Messiah, it's about two men. It doesn't go as fully into their lives as we might hope. We only get a sense of them. So at least in that regard, Mank was right.
Yeah, absolutely. Mank was correct in those regards.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have come to the end of the review. So, Peter, if people want to find you on the internets, where can they find you?
As per usual, on TikTok or Twitter or YouTube, Mr. Towerack. Oh, wait, no, on TikTok, it's just my name, Peter Wesley Salmon. But yeah, so Mr. Towerack is anywhere pretty much. And then good old Peter Wesley Salmon on the TikTok.
Where you remain the only member of the end credits panel to have taken the dive.
I know. I'm one of those. I took one for the team.
You took one for the team by joining TikTok. All right. Well, fair enough. And that is it for this week's show. We hope you liked it as always. And if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website at endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean, or get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Speaking of that Spotify app, you can get the playlist for all the music you hear on the End Credits show on Spotify. Just open that app and search for End Credits on CFRU and listen away. You can find us on our social media feeds on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back here on CFRU Thursday at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And in the meantime, I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson.
You can go to GuelphPolitico.ca for my news and politics site. And you can read my writing about horror movies at NOFSpodcast.com. That's Nightmare on Film Street at NOFSpodcast.com. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We'll be back, of course, next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for another edition of End Credits. And we will see you then.